Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this President's Day, Monday, the 16th of February. All things political, the first hour of our program. We have a great guest. I do want to make one announcement for those of you who were listening last week, expecting George McGovern on Abraham Lincoln. That'll be a great show. It has been rescheduled. It will be tomorrow, and that will be at this time period. The 10 o'clock hour tomorrow, George McGovern will be joining us. So a rescheduling of Senator McGovern. This hour of the program, David Yepsen is going to be joining us. David, you know the name, I'm sure, because he's a veteran journalist who's covered presidential campaigns for a long period of time and was in Iowa for many years. As a matter of fact, he's covered every Iowa presidential caucus campaign since 1976. And that would include Paul Simon's 1988 bid for the Democratic Convention. He wrote a book about that campaign, Winners and Losers. And he says every 4 years, the chief political reporter for the Des Moines Register, and that was David, becomes the most important reporter in the nation. It's a position that could cause vanity and abuse. But he didn't say this about himself, but to David handled the position with sensitivity and balance, and he worked very hard. Actually, the person who wrote that about David was Paul Simon. And now Yepsen is going to be leading the institute that Paul Simon founded in Illinois. He will become Southern Illinois University Carbondale new director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, and he will start his duties on April 1st. So that's terrific. He joined the Des Moines Register as the police and county government reporter in 1974, and he has been writing his political column, which has appeared three times a week since 2000. Of course, you saw a great deal of him because of the importance of Iowa and because of his great political coverage during the last presidential campaign. We have a lot to talk about, some things from Illinois. We'll touch on Roland Burris this hour. We'll look at the stimulus bill, of course, what's going to happen with mortgages. It will also be talking about the car companies and on and on the list goes. All that's on the plate of President Obama this hour. And welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. David, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's good to be with you, Kathleen.
And congratulations on the new appointment. I think it sounds fun.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
I would imagine you are. Isn't it interesting that there you are now and you had covered Paul Simon and he wrote about you and now you're at the Institute. It's like it was meant to be.
Yeah, there's some. It is nice. It is very nice.
Yeah. I always thought that he would go farther nationally. I could have seen Paul Simon as president of the country.
I could have, too. And I think, but for a few thousand votes in 1988, yeah. it might have happened. Dick Gephardt narrowly beat him in those caucuses, and that Simon's presidential campaign ended shortly after that. But he was a classy man, and he walked out under his own power from the Senate in 1997, and went to Southern Illinois University, back home to Southern Illinois, where he started this institute to kind of keep his hand in things. And it's a very eclectic institute. We teach classes. I will be. They work on public policy questions that interested the senator. He used the institute to start a rural dental clinic in Southern Illinois.
Really?
He got into international water policy. He is a big believer in the notion that clean water ought to be a principle of American foreign policy, that if the world is drinking clean water, people will be healthier and things will be more peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
And what a great humanitarian thought. And he worked very hard, and that has got some legislation passed. They're into just a variety of things, and that's what appeals to me, the notion of working with students, doing a little writing, being in the classroom, having time to read a book or two now and then. Who couldn't enjoy that?
Yeah, exactly. And then you can go back for a guest thing somewhere in Iowa in 4 years, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, you'll be wanting to do that. Didn't David Axelrod work with Paul Simon?
Yes, he did. And David Axelrod has worked with a variety of clients in the Middle West, and Simon was one of them. They all come out of the kind of the reform agenda in Illinois, or the reform effort in Illinois. And So, yeah, they were very close.
Mm-hmm. I think about Iowa so much. What an incredibly important state that was to what we're experiencing now with President Obama. The fact that he's president is, you know, in some ways linked to what happened in Iowa.
That's true. This state, the fact these caucuses occur in Iowa, which is 97% white, has always been a point of contention with the critics of the caucus process, that the state does not demographically reflect the entire country, and that's correct. And so for Barack Obama to come here and to stage a victory did a couple things. First of all, legitimized him with other voters around the country, particularly African Americans, who in South Carolina were lining up behind Hillary Clinton, saw that Obama could in fact win white voters, and rallied to his banner. So I thought that was very important for Obama, and sort of lit the rocket that he rode to the nomination.
Yeah. We were in Dubuque for a broadcast, and I'll never forget the night of that caucus. We were in a very large room in Dubuque at the library, and you could sense it almost immediately with the number of young people who were in that room and how that particular caucus, which was large, went for Obama overwhelmingly. I thought, ooh, there's something going on here that we didn't quite anticipate.
Yeah, that's true. I remember the first time Barack Obama came to Iowa. It was in 2006. For a fundraiser for Senator Tom Harkin, and it was very popular and well known because of that speech he gave to the 2004 Democratic National Convention, and there were thousands of people who showed up, and I didn't know a lot of them, and I've been covering politics in this state for over 30 years, and I generally go to most political fundraisers, and if I don't know half the names there, I certainly know
right.
half the faces.
Right.
And these were all new people, particularly younger people, but it was quite a phenomenon, and we did first see it here.
Right. Tomorrow he signs this $787 billion stimulus bill. There's question now about whether or not it's enough. It's a huge bill. It's the largest bill, I guess, in history, stimulus bill. What are your thoughts on it? Is it large enough or not? Does each stand a good chance of creating the number of jobs he would like to create in the next year, or saving them?
I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question. I do think that this is the passage of this bill is clearly a huge victory for the president. He achieved in this legislation a great deal of everything he was talking about during the campaign. Secondly, they did it with Democrats. The Republicans opted out of this, didn't feel a part of it. And so this is now a Democratic deal, and there will be accountability in a couple years. If they succeed, if it works, then President Obama and the Democrats will have something to crow about. If the country is still mired in a recession, then at some point voters are going to start holding him and them accountable. The problem that I see with the stimulus bill is a psychological one. This country is in a national funk. We are all hunkering down. I have a great job. My spouse has a great job. And yet we even find ourselves saying, well, maybe we shouldn't spend money on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're sort of talking ourselves into this, into a real recessionary environment. We're supposed to save, and yet we're supposed to spend. And I don't know that anything in that stimulus bill will change that psychology. But overnight, we all say, okay, get the credit card out again.
Right.
And so I think that's going to be a big problem. And I think, frankly, the Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, did a very poor job in rolling out his bank protection measures. The man just exudes no self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the fact there aren't any weren't any details to his plan. You listen to him speak, and people think, my gosh, he may be smart, but this man is in charge of our economy now. So I think the Obama administration has got a long way to go.
You think they made a mistake in appointing him?
I don't know if it was a mistake in appointing him, but he's had two big strikes. One was his whole tax mess, and secondly was the way he conducted this rollout of the bank bailout plan. It was a flop, and the market went down 400 points. And, I can't stand many more of these politicians. President Bush used to do this. He'd come on to talk about the economy, and the stock market would tank.
Mm-hmm.
And, my 401k can't afford much more stimulating, if that's what the effect
right,
of it is.
Right.
And so I think Geithner has got some issues there that he's going to have to, he's got to come back somehow, or he may be ineffective as Treasury Secretary.
Yeah. You would have thought he would have had a plan, a specific plan to present to everybody. He knew how important it was. The president knew how important it was. And most people would agree with you that it was a flop.
Yeah, the expectations were so high. But it's also true the way he delivered it. I mean, you think back to Franklin Roosevelt and the whole fear itself thing. What was one of Roosevelt's great successes as president? It was not that he had a bunch of programs. They debate today whether the New Deal did it. But the man just exuded self-confidence. He had a great smile. He was upbeat. It was decisive. I think this imagery is more important than maybe we give it credit for. It is not, isn't it something you teach in an economics class, but it's psychology. It's a sense that the American people have to have that somebody's in charge, that they have their act together, and they're optimistic about the future of the country. And Geithner just didn't produce on that score either.
Yeah, but what about Obama? Does he produce on that score?
I think he does some. His first press conference, I thought, was a mixed bag. I gave him about a B. You could tell he was a little nervous, a little hesitant from time to time. But when he opens up with that big grin,
yes,
you know, it just radiates confidence. And that's the kind of thing I think the American people need more than anything else right now, is a sense that somebody in Washington is finally in charge and better days will be ahead.
David, why did the Republicans opt out pretty much completely from this stimulus bill? What are they thinking?
Well, first of all, Republicans oftentimes think the only cure for anything is a tax cut. And there is a place for tax cuts in financial policy, and that's true. I think the reason Republicans opted out is they aren't sure what they stand for. They're coming off two bad elections. They're in a process of rebuilding. Secondly, they were criticized for forgetting their fiscal roots during the last 8 years, and you know, so now they're kind of getting back to basics. I mean, it is true the national debt, the national deficit skyrocketed during the Bush administration. So I think Republicans may be trying to get religion, getting back to the basics, trying to find themselves and what they stand for. And some of them are just, you know, they're waking up after a long party and saying, no, we can't do this anymore. The problem is it comes off as sort of Herbert Hooverish, you know, that they're not going to do anything. So I think Republicans have to make it very clear what they're for, not just what they're against.
Mm-hmm. The president's just given one part of this bill. Well, he needs to amplify on what's going to happen with the banks. But we got car companies now wanting more money. There's going to be an announcement this week about mortgages. The bank thing needs to happen. It is one thing after another.
Yeah, and if you think about it, there are so many details and nuances and problems that it's not clear any of it is going to work. It's such a Rube Goldberg proposition. But I think what we do know is that this country is headed for a period of great inflation. Now, almost everyone will tell you that we're printing money in order to bail ourselves out. And I can understand that. I remember I was interviewing Senator Durbin one time, and I was asking him about the cost of all this. And he said, look, you know, when the patient is bleeding, you don't ask about the cost of the tourniquet. Hmm. And all right, so we're gonna spend money, print money. At some point, Kathleen, this will come home to roost. And I think the country will be headed to a period of great inflation. But that may be better than the alternative, which is, you know, an economic collapse.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the president's going to find it more difficult when we get some kind of mortgage relief bill, when the bank bill gets more solidified? Are these going to be even more difficult pieces of legislation than the stimulus bill?
Yes, they'll be difficult to pass. There'll be other nuances, but they're almost, you know, the Republicans can participate in this. But I think President Obama, again, has to take a page from Franklin Roosevelt and try something. If it works, great. If it doesn't, move on. Don't dwell on what went wrong. He just has to keep trying and searching for solutions for things that will work. The economists say you have to get these bad loans off the books of banks somehow. Those are things that are real easy to talk about and to say, but actually doing it is a fairly difficult task.
And now we're getting a bit of a change in terms of what we're going to do for the car companies. They're coming back to Washington, I understand. We've already given them a whole lot of money. Do you anticipate that GM may go bankrupt here? Is it worthwhile for the administration and for us to try and save it?
A lot of people smarter than you and me are saying we have no choice, that there are, in fact, some companies too big to fail. you know, actually some of the vehicles they're producing now are quite good. You look at Consumer Reports, for example, and other publications, and they're finally getting their act together. And some of their enterprises are doing quite well overseas. So I think the politicians can all sense that these companies are too big to fail, and that they will have to do something to try to keep them afloat. And as long as the taxpayer gets an equity position in this, it might in fact work. I just can't envision a situation where the president and the Congress say, we're done. We can't, you might as well go ahead and file for bankruptcy. I think just psychologically, that would just be incredibly damaging to this country.
Mm-hmm. It seems as though when you talk about confidence, another thing that the Democrats are getting at, and I wonder how important this is changing this corporate culture that has existed in this country in terms of the number of executives who are getting these walloping, huge salaries and taking these lavish trips, et cetera. It's interesting. The Senate Democrats made this a tougher piece of legislation than what the president wanted. What about that culture in this country? Do you see that changing? There's a big perception, I think, on the part of the American people that there's a lot of greed going on right now.
That's right. It's sort of the golden age of the late 1800s, and
yeah.
Look what that led to. It's amazing to me how corporate officers just don't get it. We mm-hmm. have talked about politicians who get out of touch, but some of these CEOs really are out of touch with where average Americans are. And I think now they're starting to realize the error of their ways. But it has to go beyond gimmicks. It can't be about corporate jets, and it can't be just about driving to Washington. It's got to be a change in culture. The gap between what we pay the CEOs in this country and the average worker in this country has widened, and somehow that's got to come back together. I don't know whether you bring corporate executives down or you bring workers up. I think the latter may be the better course here, but corporate CEOs, they just have got a tin ear. I cover politics and politicians, and I'm just amazed that business people who are supposed to be attuned to consumer preferences can act in such ways that it just turns off those same consumers. Americans just are very down on corporations right now.
David Yepsen is our guest for All Things Political. He very soon, on April 1st, will become the new director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He, of course, has been a longtime columnist and reporter for the Des Moines Register, and you see him most prominently every 4 years, and you saw a lot of them during the last run because of the importance of Iowa. He has also, he's been a commentator on Iowa politics and presidential caucus campaigns on Meet the Press, Face the Nation, This Week, National Public Radio, CNN, MSNBC. He served as a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard Kennedy School, where he led a group of students who were looking at the presidential nominating process, and he also was a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. One line is open if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Monday, can you increase your level of happiness and experience by practicing meditation? Our guest is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and has done this very important work with monks to determine what happens with the brains. And they've learned so much about how you can connect neurons once again through meditation. He will be with us to talk about one of our inalienable rights, the pursuit of happiness. David Yepsen is with us now. Let's go to your phone calls. Bruce from Milwaukee, our first caller. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, thank you for the show. I always like hearing from David and from you, Kathleen. My question has to do with credit card debt, which is huge on a family basis, and whether changes in the bankruptcy laws are forthcoming on that, or is that just so overshadowed by mortgage foreclosures that will not be addressed in the near future?
Well, Bruce, I think the political community will have to address that, but I do think the mortgage situation is probably going to take priority. And the credit card issue, you know, here's the dilemma. Economic recovery requires us to spend, to buy things. And yet at the same time, we're told Americans have not been saving enough. And so I don't quite know how politicians are going to calibrate that. They did pass bankruptcy legislation that some Democrats believe is too hard on people. I think the business community and the banking community would push back and say, my gosh, you know, we're already bleeding and hurting here. How can we afford to write down any more credit card debt? So it is an issue. You are correct, Bruce. I just don't know if anyone has a good, clear solution yet. But it's something clearly they've got to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce, for your call. Mike from Milwaukee, hello.
Yeah, I heard you say that if you think that inflation is better than going into a depression, I think that's what you said.
Yes.
You think that a false prosperity is better than risking a depression. We call it a severe recession. We don't call it a depression, right? I don't think you could be more wrong. I think that a depression is just an adjustment period in the supply and demand cycle. Now, there's only two laws of the economy, really, when you filter out all the gibberish that people talk. One is the law of supply and demand, and the other is the law that there's no such thing as something for nothing. And so what you're doing, basically, is increasing the money supply faster than the goods and services are growing in the nation, and that you're being diluted. This is a false prosperity, and I think it's going to result, if we actually do this, we're going to result in a total economic collapse.
Mike, you may be right. No one is saying that, you know, it's a choice between the lesser of two evils. What I'm reporting to you is that most of the political leaders I talk to say that a period of higher inflation is preferable to another depression. You are correct. We are a long way from a Great Depression. Those who lived through it will tell you that is not something they want anybody to go through again. It led to war. It had a horrible effect on the world. So I tend to agree with you. Both are bad. I don't know, though, without inflating the money supply, how the federal government can use the vehicle that they traditionally have used to reinvigorate economy, which is priming the pump. I mean, how would you do that?
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Tom from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. My question is, Obama talks about limiting CEO compensation. I would say probably the best thing would be to limit bonuses and just put everybody on salary in the whole financial network. The other question I got is did Morgan Stanley, were they trading in commodities that caused the gas crisis with the elevation and to $4 a gallon, because that was brought up in one talking, too.
Yeah, Tom, I don't know the answer to your last question there. In terms of the first question about executive compensation, you know, here's the dilemma. I mean, you know, we think of ourselves as a capitalistic society, and yet the role of government is to somehow be a little bit of a leveler off some of the excesses of capitalism. So you want people to have an incentive to work hard, to be entrepreneurial, to produce results for themselves, for their businesses, and with some sort of financial reward at the end. But at what point does that get carried away? I think that's the debate. And frankly, President Obama hasn't been as rabid about this as some other people inside the Democratic Party. So I think that's the sort of the argument that we have to have with ourselves is how do you give people an incentive, a financial incentive, to produce, to succeed, to invent, while at the same time then not letting it get so far out of hand that it becomes abusive and there's a concentration of great wealth. I think wealthy people in this country have to conduct themselves differently so as not to alienate the middle class. I think that's their problem.
Right. Thanks very much for the call. A few words on this seems to get trickier and trickier every day. The new senator from what will be your new state, Roland Burris, is he in trouble here with not saying all that he should have said when people were questioning him?
Yes.
About his? Yes, he is.
I mean, there's no question about that, and it, political people in Illinois tell me that there could be a primary. You know, the Senator Burris has a long way to go before he wins a full term in his own right. He was already suffering from some taint and liability because he was Blagojevich's choice. Now he comes forward and says, well, wasn't quite as forthcoming as I should have been.
Yeah.
Republicans have pounced on this. So Democrats are going to have a good argument in their primary about whether he ought to be the best candidate they field in November.
Hmm. Todd is next from Green Bay. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay, great. I just want to make a few comments. I like most of your comments, but I don't think you move the argument forward when you say that. Now that we've had this huge supply-side debacle again, we have enough supply. We have enough printing presses making toilet paper. We need people to have money to be able to buy the toilet paper. We have a lack of people having demand. And I'm a financial planner, and now I'm finding out that, well, I knew this before, but now it's all over the TV, CNBC, what have you, 60 Minutes last night, that mortgages were giving out on stated income, meaning dead people's income sometimes are put on the mortgages. That's why the banks are in this huge mess. And now you got Fox News going this big thing, $5 trillion. They put all the dollars up there. George Bush spent, or $1 trillion. George Bush spent like almost $10 trillion the last 8 years. Fox News never said a minute of it. And now we have $1 trillion with a T on Fox News. I just don't think you move the argument forward when you put this all on Obama's plate now and everyone's blaming Obama for the deficit. Since Reagan, I'm 44 years old, the Republicans have blown up the deficits. Obama's not going to be able to fix it in 2 years. And for you to blame it on him that if he can't, now we got to give the Republicans another chance, it's just not moving the discussion forward.
Well, Todd, I don't think it moves the discussion forward to sit here and wallow in the past over, who's more responsible. We are where we are as a country. And I think what I'm trying to describe to you are a couple things. One is, how should Republicans act? They do own a fair problem with the deficit. But are we going to sit here and argue over whether Reagan's deficits or Bush's deficits were good or bad? We are. That's ancient history. You know, as I said, economists still argue over whether the New Deal worked or not. The political reality is the Democrats are in control of the presidency and the Congress. Voters will hold them accountable. The question, one of the great questions in politics right now, is how long will people give them? The American people agree with what you said. Yeah, this happened on Bush's watch, and the Republicans ran up the debt. But at some point, Americans are going to expect this president and this Congress to produce results. So we can argue over who's more responsible for how we got here. I think the question that the average American wants answered, and your clients want answered, is what do we do now?
Mm-hmm. And he's only been in office a month. We do have to remember that. But he has even said, if these things don't work out, I'm a one-term president.
Hey, Todd?
Are you there, Todd?
He's left us.
Todd's gone.
I just was curious what he was advising his clients to do with what's left of their 401ks.
Right. Todd, where are you? Call us back. Our number is 800-486-8655 for you to join our All Things Political conversation with David Yepsen, the new director starting in April of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. David, of course, a longtime veteran journalist for the Des Moines Register, covering politics for many years and writing much noticed column about politics 3 times a week for the Des Moines Register. Let's go to Jan next from Sauk City. Hi, Jan.
Hi there. I am probably not even lower middle class on my income. I'm probably below that. I am over 60. My question is, I hear a lot of talk, which is fine, about helping the foreclosures and so on, and that's fine. That's great. I have chosen to make my house payments over many of my other bills. I have credit card debt, which I can't pay. I pay enough on my electricity, my heat, and so on, so that I don't get it shut off. And I was wondering, is there going to be any help at any time for people like me who are not in foreclosure? I would never qualify for another loan because my credit has gotten very bad. So basically, is there going to be any help for people who are not in foreclosure but are having a terribly hard time making their house payment? I'll take my answer off the air because I'm on a cell phone.
All right,
Jim. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Jan, the answer to your question is no. It sounds like you're getting by. There are a lot of people, which is admirable, and you've sacrificed to do that. But right now, the country has got to deal with problems. And nothing that you mentioned there indicates to me that there's anything that Congress or the President are considering to try to directly help someone like you. You know, those of us who pay our bills and are living in a hard time, you know, about all we're going to get out of this is getting a better economy. Even though, you know, you're paying your mortgage and people have their homes paid for, it's not really going to do us any good if the mortgage market collapses because of all the bad mortgage there. I mean, we've all suffered because the value of our homes has declined. And so I think that's about all that most Americans are going to get out of it, is hopefully at some point that there's a bottom put under this drop in home values. But I honestly, you know, I hear what you're saying. You hear this from a lot of people are struggling to get by, but they're getting by. And I think a political leader would tell you that the best that they can hope for is to get the economy going so that your job opportunities are better, your educational opportunities are better, prices it's more affordable. I think that's probably about all you're going to get out of it.
Mm. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, morning. Two questions on two completely different subjects. First, I'm a business person, and it seems to me that the overriding thing is right now there's a lack of confidence. In other words, I don't feel confidence in my small business to hire people.
Right.
And multiply that times millions of people like me, and if there's no confidence, you know, I look at this, I listen to them. To me, it sounds like a circus. I'm concerned with Obama's picks for his cabinet. It shows a lack of judgment, not perhaps on Obama's part, but, you know, his vetting process. It makes me unconfident.
Who are you nervous about in the cabinet, Mike?
Well, I mean, I don't know how many picks he's had that have gotten shot down for one reason or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a good start, mm-hmm. You know. And so I say to myself, well, you know, I've got X number of people who work for me now. I'm going to try to hold on to them and you know, let them continue on with their jobs. But am I going to hire somebody? No way. Mm-hmm. Not until I get confidence. And it's me times, you know, I don't know, a couple of tens of millions probably who are like me, who hire people, but who feel absolutely no confidence and see this whole thing as a circus.
And I agree. And that's what I was saying earlier. American people have to get their confidence back.
Mm-hmm. Number two, please, is we're all concentrating on the economy as we should be. I'm asking myself, are we taking our eye off the ball on two very big problems that we have out there, Iran and Pakistan, which at some point in time, something's going to pop there, and it's going to cost us, again, you know, tens of millions or trillions of dollars, which we don't have. I'm a little bit worried that we're concentrating too much on one and kind of letting the other ones fall through the cracks.
I think you have a good point there. The history of American politics is domestic issues trump foreign policy until there's a crisis. Americans can be a little bit isolationist, particularly here in the Middle West, in our part of the world. You know, when people are having trouble paying their home mortgages, when they're worried about losing their jobs, you know, they're not too worried about what Iran or Pakistan is doing. And I'm not saying, or North Korea. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's the way it is. And we tend to wait and let overseas problems fester until they turn into a crisis. It looks to me, based upon some of the president's early diplomatic initiatives, that he's just trying to cool things down a little bit, trying to extend diplomatic overtures, trying to end some of the hard rhetoric that the Bush administration employed, talk to people, to just buy some time before you know, he can deal with these concerns abroad. And I have to tell you that a healthy American economy is going to be of enormous benefit to world peace. You know, the people who abroad who can't work, who start to starve, I mean, the American illness is going to spread, and that will have disastrous consequences for the rest of the world. We have seen that pattern in history before. And so, in a sense, getting the American economy healthy is probably one of the best things that this president can do to foster world peace.
Hmm. And yet he already has envoys. He's got Holbrooke in Afghanistan right now. He's got Mitchell, a Middle East envoy. He's got Clinton on the road. He has talked about Iran and using diplomatic overtures there.
Right.
It is a change, and it does point to the importance of those regions, don't you think?
Yes, and I see it. Oh, no one's saying they're unimportant. I sense he's trying to cool it a little bit, trying to reach out, saying the new sheriff here in the United States, let's talk some more before mm-hmm. we start launching missiles and testing things. And so I think he's trying to buy some time here.
Right, yeah. Thanks, Mike, for the call. John from Madison, hi.
Hi, good morning, David. I'm curious. I'm in the newspaper business myself, and I'm just interested in any thoughts you might have about the state of our industry as you're about to be exiting the industry, I guess, and particularly perhaps any parting words of advice for those of us still in the industry as you head off into some new challenges.
I think all of us in the media business, print, radio, television, have suffered because of the changing business model. The internet has eaten into everybody's revenue base, and that's causing great. I mean, it even has affected national public radio, and so everybody's having to reinvent themselves. I think the best thing people who are hoping to enter the news business or who are in the news business today can do is to become diverse players. You've got to have a lot variety of work skills. I find I wasn't just a columnist, and I was a content provider. Here I do radio commentaries, I do public television appearances, I write a blog. You've got to make yourself diverse, and a lot of newspapers have pretty crummy websites, and yet that is probably what the future is going to be. The what we call the dead tree version of the newspaper, the print edition, is going by the boards in favor of different platforms. So people have to get, young journalists particularly, have to, I think, get comfortable with blogs and use of the internet and Twitter and all these other different mechanisms that are out there, social networks, in order to become profitable. I still have to believe that there's going to be a role for journalism in the future, because I think most people want to do something than read somebody else's blog. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're going to do for news in the future, is just read each other's blogs?
Right.
I don't think so. I think people are going to be looking for somebody who can provide some credible information to them in the future. Now, how we make a profit at that, that's going to be the case. And finally, one last thing. There is a new model being discussed for newspapers that instead of being privately owned, they're owned by nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
And so that these crushing demands that shareholders have on these enterprises can be reduced or eliminated, and we simply run it the way you run public radio, which is a nonprofit, and you get contributions and you get donations and you sell subscriptions and that kind of thing. That may be a model that works.
As long as the economy gets better so people can make those contributions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
I mean, what's hit newspapers particularly, Kathleen, is we had the competition from the internet. And that was, people turning to the internet, and it's killing local television stations. So it isn't just newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
But then on top of that comes the economy. And historically, whenever the economy turns south, anybody that sells advertising sees a little bit of a downturn. You try to weather your way through it until the economy gets better.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen, John? Oh, John is gone. All right, let's pause for just a moment and return. David Yepsen is our guest for All Things Political. Our number is 800-486-8655. Oh, you can send an email, too. I totally forgot. You can do that today. That's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, George McGovern will be joining us to talk about Abraham Lincoln. So he has a new book on Abraham Lincoln. Back to phone calls for David Yepsen. Let's go to John from La Crosse next. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a college freshman, and I'm just wondering, as I talk to my fellow students, it's where we want to be able to help in any way with, to reboot the economy, but we also were just wondering if you have any advice for us as far as avoiding this sort of situation when we're older and we're in charge of the country. And because we see how desperate it is right now, and we're not really sure how we can help or things we can start doing now to avoid this happening in the future.
I have a couple thoughts for you, John. Number one, get your education. The best long-term stimulus package for this country is education. It lies with empowering our people. And when it starts with your generation, you have to put yourself in a position where you're going to be able to compete with other people your age around the world. Secondly, learn some history. Learn some economic history. Much of what we're going through now is not new. You've heard us talking about inflation and whether that's better than taking a depression. We talked about the Gilded Age that this country has been through. We've seen that before. Ben Bernanke is a great student of the Great Depression, and I think that's probably a good thing. So that was because he can hopefully avoid some of the mistakes that they made back then. So that's a second thing that you can do. A third thing is to keep your credit cards under management. I think many young people are financially illiterate. A lot of us are, but I am struck by the number of younger Americans, millennials, people under age 25 who are financially illiterate. So if you haven't done so already, learn yourself about how to manage your own money and your own personal finances. Debt is not necessarily bad as long as it goes for a long-term purpose. The money you borrow for your education is good. I'm not sure it's wise to run up your credit card buying concert tickets. So those are three things. That's a very good question you ask, and those are three things that I think you could do.
What are you studying, John?
I'm a political science major.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Good.
Good.
Yeah, good. We both agree. That's a good way to go. Thanks very much for your call. Well, that's nice. A young person who wants to learn from the past and even learn from you, David, huh?
Isn't that great?
That's great.
Hopefully they won't make the same mistakes that I have made.
Thanks, John. Well, we got to make those mistakes, I guess. Brian is next. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi there, David. Thanks for taking my call. I've heard from some of your responses, there seems to be an emphasis in your beliefs about solving this, getting the health of the economy back on consumer spending. Getting people out of the funk of saving, getting back, spending some money. I don't disagree that that's important, but, President Obama is emphasizing, rebuilding the infrastructure, our manufacturing, our exports. And, I haven't heard you say anything about that. I want to hear your opinions on the role of rebuilding infrastructure to get our economy back into long-term health. I'll take my answer off the air because I'm on the cell phone.
All right, Brian, thank you.
It's enormously important. And I think that's one area where there is some broad agreement that rebuilding infrastructure in this country is a good long-term investment. It employs people right away, and then secondarily, it creates an economic asset that continues to produce economic advantages later on. And historically, it's been a role that government has had. I mean, government was involved in building canals. Government was involved in building railroads across the country. Government certainly was involved in building the interstates. So I don't think you have any hang up here about the role of government in building infrastructure. I think we have to pay some attention to the human infrastructure that's out there. As I mentioned earlier, I think investing in education is really the only long-term stimulus that we can do. It's a dilemma. I mean, the president was asked about this in his press conference. What's more important? Do we start saving money again, or do we have to get Americans to spend money again? And there's not a black or white answer here. It's a difficult calibration. I think it goes to a question of what we are spending these dollars for. And if money is in that stimulus package that's going to build things, to pour concrete, to put wires up, that's going to be healthy. If it's just going to create a few jobs in the near term, I'm not sure that's going to be healthy. I'm a pragmatist. I think this is time for liberal ideologues and conservative ideologues to sort of step aside, and we focus on what works. I think conservatives who don't realize that, for example, increasing food stamp benefits is something that has a huge stimulative effect on the economy. I think they probably ought to reduce the payroll tax on Social Security if you want to put the money in the pockets of working people. At the same time, there is a role for fiscal responsibility here. So, you know, I don't want to come off as some sort of ideologue here, because I'm not. I'm a reporter, I'm a columnist, I'm an observer of politics, and I think Americans right now are more interested in what works.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, John, the infrastructure piece, it works and is overdue.
Kevin, hi.
Hi. Speaking of pragmatism, we've spent as a country a lot of money over the years trying to keep a huge military superiority gap over the rest of the world. And I'm just wondering, with the economy, with the way it's going and the money that we're spending, whether we're going to be able to afford to keep doing that.
There's some talk in the political community about scaling back, particularly some new weapon systems, creating more weapons platforms that can be used by different military services. But, you know, I remember covering Obama, and he would get questions like that, particularly from people on the left. And one of the things that I respected was he would say essentially what I'm going to say, and that is the American military, yes, we have to make our military more efficient. Yes, there's waste in there. Yes, it's an unproductive, it doesn't generate, a tank, for example, doesn't generate a whole lot of economic value. But, you know, you do have to have a strong military to protect the country. And right now, much of our military is a wreck. It's in tatters. We are going to have to expand the nation's military. And so I don't think that the country can look to big cuts in military spending as a way to be balancing the budget. I think they can be more frugal, but there just isn't a giant pot of money there that that is available for budget balancing or for other things.
There's a giant pot of money in Iraq, isn't there?
Well, sure, but the money you save there, you're still going to have to, you're going to spend it re-equipping units. You're going to spend it on Afghanistan. You're going to spend it on hiring additional soldiers because everyone has concluded that the American military was spread too thin and we're putting too many demands on the National Guard and the Reserve. So, you know, yeah, you'll save some money as you get out, but, you know, it's going to go elsewhere inside the military.
Mm-hmm. I need to ask you this because it is President's Day, after all. The recent, and I love these every year, 50 historians ask the best presidents, answer FDR, Teddy Roosevelt, Harry Truman. No, we start with Abraham Lincoln, Abe, George Washington, FDR, Teddy Roosevelt, Harry Truman. Do you agree?
Oh, sure. I mean, I
do
think
you?
That's history. I think one of the things, though, that I'm always troubled by these surveys because, you know, time does change views of what people did. Harry Truman is well-regarded today. At the time he left office, his job approval ratings were right about where George W. Bush's were when he left.
Mm-hmm.
So a president can be very unpopular when they leave office, and then after time, they look better. Warren Harding was quite popular when he died. Well, we don't think much of his presidency now. So, you know, these quick judgments, I think a little time will tell us about whether presidents are good or not.
Hmm. Thanks, Kevin, very much for your call. We go next to Al, running short on time, everybody, from Milwaukee. Hello, Al.
Yes, hello. I believe what we have here is a correction that's not being allowed to happen. I think what most of the American people don't realize is that we have a standard of living that's not sustainable. And I think once this correction is allowed to happen, that the country will be able to get back on its feet. I'd like to know your opinion on that.
Al, that sounds good. We're all for taking our medicine, but what's a tolerable rate of unemployment to you? I mean, what sort of increase in homelessness? What sort of increase in hunger is tolerable? I'm not sure Americans have a whole lot of tolerance for a lot of pain right now, and so that's why they're asking their political leaders to manage this. In the abstract, that sounds good, but in reality, it can be pretty cold-hearted.
Okay, I mean, I think that they have to realize that there's not really a painless solution, because either way, you print all this money, you're going to have inflation. It's going to be worse for the poor in the long run. The poor aren't going to be able to afford their basic needs
when the effects of inflation kick in.
No, that's true. And that's what I've said earlier, is that, you know, we've got a choice between the lesser of two evils here. This country is shaped by the Great Depression and a desire not to see that repeated. So we're a little more inclined to prime the pump and use government to spend money. Go to Germany, and they were shaped by the great inflation that led to Adolf Hitler. And so German bankers are much more fearful of inflation than are our bankers. So you're right, there is a correction. It's just how much pain do we want to inflict on ourselves and go through, and what kind? There's going to be pain if you take a correction. There's going to be pain if when we go through this the great inflation that's about to come.
Thanks very much for the call. David, all the best on your new job. It sounds wonderful. It'll be hard to leave Iowa, I'm sure, which is a marvelous state. But thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour.
Kathleen, thanks for having me.
David Yepsen, our guest, and starting on April 1st, he will become the new director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He, of course, has been with the Des Moines Register for a long time, covering presidential races, writing a column, being a reporter. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your calls for all things political. More to come. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.